wanted. What will we do with the horses, then? Just set them free?
Talmadge stopped grinning. We are only a day's ride from the next stable. Sell mine and do what you will with the silver.
You would leave me alone in the midst of the wilderness?
Her feigned distress brought back Talmadge's chuckle. Where you usually are, with your usual company.
Take me to the lake,
Chote said earnestly, moving right before the man and staring at him hard with her dark eyes.
Have I not earned your trust?
Talmadge leaned back from her and chewed his lip. The question was ridiculous, of course, for he had come to trust this wonderful woman implicitly. But the request alone sent his thoughts cascading back to that awful day on the southwestern banks of Loch Piag. Even all these years later, the image of dead Badger settled heavily in his memories. It was the only time Talmadge had ever killed a man, and he hadn't much enjoyed the experience. So deep was his revulsion and his shame that he didn't even want to risk anyone ever learning the truth. He shook his head. Chote started to argue, but she bit it back and simply stared hard at the man. Talmadge started to turn away, but she grabbed him roughly.
I thought,
she said when their eyes met again.
I...
She let him go and pushed him back a step, then stared at him a moment longer before shaking her head right back at him and spinning away. She gathered up the horses and was away before Talmadge had even finished loading the small sled he meant to drag to the river. She rode away hard and kept up a great pace, and rode long after sunset, arriving at a small cluster of cabins, which included one of the stables scattered about the wilderness and wilder lands trails, in time to get a fine dinner. In the morning, she surprised herself by selling both horses and most of her goods right there in the hamlet, and when she departed, right after breakfast, she didn't continue to the southwest and Matinee, but straight north. Chote knew this land fairly well, and she could track a man as well as any. She needed resolution with Talmadge. It was that simple. She loved the man, but needed more from him than a few months of most years at his side. And if he proved not worthy of that love, she'd at least know his secret mountain lake and the tribes who traded pearls. Redshanks could certainly be counted upon to facilitate the trading route he had described. And if Talmadge didn't care enough to take the man up on his offer, she would. 13. Intended. In the month since the red glow of Issibol, Aulën had noted a distinct shift in the attitude of Shona, one that had her continually off balance in her duties, and even a little fearful. Aulën couldn't really put her finger on it, and eventually she just shrugged and tried to let it go, glad that Shona wasn't heaping added duties upon her. And so, this particular midsummer morning, she expected to be released from her lessons, to wander the encampment when twilight descended, to find some scraps among the tables set out around the central bonfire, where the meal was being cooked by a group of women who were not in the coven. She finished her last chore, repairing a basket Shona had accidentally burned on one corner, and presented the item, then bowed and moved to leave the tent. But Shona called her back.
Not this day, child, she said. Wash your face and sit here.
Aulën hardly heard the words, but the woman's tone struck her profoundly. The edge was softer than Aulën was used to hearing from Shona, or anyone else for that matter.
Had Shona garnered some more information about her indiscretion? Had she discovered that the refuge to which Aulën had referred wasn't the one harboring the slaves, but the sacred grove far up the mountain?
Aulën reminded herself not to infer too much here. The young woman sucked in her breath. Where had she erred? She had crossed the winter plateau, barely aware of her surroundings, in her flight from the scene with Badlan's mother. But the Uskar Forfach
The elder was up there, of course. He was always there. Had he seen her?
She tried to replay her journey through the winter camp. She hadn't seen any sign of the old man, or anyone else. She'd even looked to his cottage, one of the few permanent structures up on the plateau. She glanced at Shona. The woman hadn't left at all this day. How would she have gotten any news?
The young woman frowned. The crystals, of course. The witches could see over great distances, could even free their spirits to wander the forest and mountainsides.
So it was whispered. But Aulin shook her head and dismissed her suspicion, reminding herself that Shona hadn't even known she was out of the camp until she had volunteered the information. She glanced at the witch again and tried to calm herself. And when that didn't work, she reminded herself that Shona was one of them, one of the Uskar. And they were all ugly and mean and cruel. They kept slaves.
Aulin was still snarling when Shona lightly touched her shoulder, and as her head snapped around, the older woman motioned to a cushion of woven dried reeds, stuffed with fluffy white wool that the war party had brought back from their latest raids on the lake tribes. Aulin hesitated, looking about the room, and then studying Shona's face, looking for some clue as to what was happening. She found no such hints, and a tickle of fear had her considering fleeing the tent and the encampment once more. She could outrun the older woman to escape into the rising dusk, and it might be worth the inevitable beating she'd take upon her return, just to see the look on Shona's face after yet another act of defiance. But Aulin dismissed that course almost immediately. She found that she was more curious than afraid. Shona was hinting at something different this night, and Aulin wanted to know what it might be. Perhaps she'd regretted. That seemed the most likely thing to her, but she shrugged and moved to take her seat. Shona grabbed her by the shoulder, gently, and turned her about until Aulin's back was to the woman. Aulin did not resist as Shona began smoothing her thick black hair. The older woman's strong hands, which could be so rough and mean when they slapped Aulin, were firm and gentle now, and, strangely, soothing. Aulin felt Shona's fingers moving through her hair, massaging her scalp, twisting and wrapping strands, as if she were weaving a basket or a sleeping mat. The woman's hands moved deftly, swiftly, as if they had done this 1,000 times and 1,000 more. Aulin thought herself a fine basket weaver, though she disliked the work quite thoroughly. But she realized now, feeling Shona working her hair into a perfect braid, how amateur her own movements truly were. When Shona was finished, which was not very long at all, the woman stepped back and glanced to the side to regard Aulin's reflection in a polished silver mirror. She was smiling widely when she bade Aulin to do the same. Aulin was feeling quite off balance by then. She rose tentatively and moved to glance at her reflection, something she did not often do. She brought a hand up to her hair to feel Shona's masterful work, but she was quite cautious, fearful of disturbing the braid. The hair from the right side of her head was pulled up and back, braided with the hair from the center, leaving her right temple and ear exposed. On her left, her hair hung wild and free, untied, protecting that side of her head. Shona handed the girl a small doeskin bag.
"When we reach the fire, empty the bag into it," she instructed.
Aulin squeezed the bag with her hand, finding it squishy and shifting, as if filled with 1,000 tiny beads. Curious, she pulled back the top flap and peeked into the container, to find it full of seeds. "These are from the pine cones," she said aloud as she sorted it out.
"You thought that day's task mere busy work," Shona chided. "Yes, those seeds and more like them are the fruits of your labor.
But what are they for?"
"They are to be cast into the fire when we arrive."
Aulin stared at her, then at the seeds, then back at Shona. By that point, Shona had her hand out towards the young woman, open-palmed,
holding a simple small flint knife that appeared quite old and quite well worn.
"And you will also need this."
Owlin took it hesitatingly.
"Am I to throw this in the fire too, then?"
she asked earnestly, completely at a loss. Shona's stern glare in response warned Owlin that Shona thought she was being mocked. The younger woman quickly painted a confused look on her own face, doubling down on that honest expression to show Shona that such was not the case. But Shona had put her off balance again.
"Not into the fire. When he demands the blade, you're to hand it to him," Shona said matter-of-factly,
and she turned toward the tent's exit.
"He?"
Owlin asked. But of course Shona did not respond, and simply strode purposefully from the tent. After a brief moment of doubt, Owlin tied the pouch of seeds onto her belt, tucked the knife in beside it, and skipped fast to follow, growing more curious with each step out of the tent. She knew they were not going to the bonfire for a meal. They moved right through the camp and crossed the perimeter, the sentries offering not so much as a nod. Owlin's hungry stomach grumbled at the injustice, but she kept her thoughts to herself.
"Night will soon fall,"
Owlin said with some concern, for the moon was expected to be full this night, and she had heard the whispers that Isabel might soon return in her red glory. Even without that daunting possibility, nights on Fíorach's Buir were fraught with danger. Shona didn't answer, other than to lift a crystal that shone like the stars, lighting the way out of the encampment and up the mountain trail. The pair continued to climb, ascending the mountainside, the same path Owlin had walked the night of the blood moon. Was that the secret here? Owlin wondered, her thoughts spinning. Were they going to the sacred grove of Uskar? How did they know?
"We cannot get back,"
Owlin said.
"Be quiet, girl," Shona replied. "There will be no blood moon this night.
The seer spoke that it might be so."
"The seer spoke as the Uskarigin instructed,"
Shona interrupted. The older woman stopped and turned back, facing Owlin directly.
"It might be a blood moon,"
Owlin said sheepishly.
"Do you think we do not know these things?" Shona asked. "Do you think I would have brought you out here if the demon Fossa was hunting?"
"We are halfway to the Winter Plateau."
"More than halfway,"
Shona corrected, and she turned and started up the mountainside at a brisk pace. Before they arrived at the Winter Plateau, a fire came into view, high up on the ledge above and beyond the grove, higher than the Uma's caves even. Owlin paused and swallowed hard. The fire was up near where she had seen the demon Fossa that terrible night. Was that a part of this journey? She felt then that she was surely to be punished. It took Shona turning back many heartbeats later to even inform the girl that she was falling far behind.
"Come along,"
the woman ordered.
The hairs on Owlin's neck stood up as she recalled those red eyes of the hunting demon, the stare that had gone right through her, that had mocked her, that had promised her a horrible death.
She wanted to say something to Shona, but the woman had turned away once more and was pushing far ahead. For all of her courage, Owlin did not want to be out alone in the darkness. When Shona reached the edge of the Winter Plateau and did not slow, it occurred to Owlin that perhaps they were heading to the sacred chasm, Kresa Diad, the mouth of God, a thought that excited her greatly. She had been there only once before, but she had been much younger, and hardly remembered the place, and certainly she could not have then appreciated the importance of it. She hustled to catch up to Shona, who was moving more slowly then, her eyes cast downward.
"Proper respect, girl," she whispered.
Owlin glanced up at her curiously, then glanced past her and understood, for from the open flap of the lone tent on the plateau, she noted a form, a man, staring out at her.
The Usgar Forfach.
Aulin Castor gazed to the ground and moved closer to Shona's side. As with many of the Usgar, particularly the younger members of the tribe, the Usgar Forfach was more myth than reality. She hadn't seen him that night a month ago when she had passed very near to this place, not once, but twice. But she hadn't looked very hard. If her sacrilege was known, it was because the Usgar Forfach had seen her. Aulan found it difficult to breathe. Aulan grimaced and stopped. Shona said nothing, but quickly reached back and grabbed Aulan by the shoulder, and when Aulan shrugged away, Shona grabbed her by the braided hair and tugged her along.
Do not tarry in the night of the Usgar Forfach, when the tribe is in the encampment far below,
Shona warned her quietly as they passed through and out the far side of the plateau. To Alan's surprise, then, Shona did not veer toward the sacred grove, nor toward the Uma's caves and the path that led up to the mouth of God. Instead, she led Aulan along a wilder route of broken stones and scrub bushes, making a direct line to the fire that burned high above. They were not climbing any path, though, and indeed were descending into a bowl, and the course took them to the base of a sheer cliff directly below the fire. They weren't far from the winter camp, nor from the sacred grove, but in a place where Aulan had never been. Of course, the Usgar didn't wander much from the camp during the winter months, after all, for the snow always lay deep. And surely they didn't come to the cliffs, where the huge black-winged rocks perched. That thought at first terrified Aulan, but then brought a bit of a smile to her face, despite her trepidation. She remembered the old crone who had raised her. The woman telling her often that the rocks would have little trouble in grabbing up a small girl with their mighty talons. It was just a story to frighten her, Aulan had come to believe. Again, despite her reservations, despite her fears that her crime had been discovered and that she had been brought out here to be punished, she couldn't help but marvel at how different the world was beginning to seem to her, how more completely and wonderfully her heart and mind, now as a young woman, was beginning to weave together what had not so long ago seemed as discordant pieces and wild stories of a very big mountain. Shona stood right before the cliff face, one hand in a fist, head bowed, eyes closed as if in deep concentration. Aulan glanced around, but saw no path, nor cut stair. She wanted to ask if they had reached their destination, or how they might scale the cliff in the darkness. Before she could, though, Shona glanced at her, and nodded to the stone before her, the woman's gaze directing Aulan to a cleverly cut hole in the stone. A handhold? And inspecting it closely in the starlight of Shona's crystal, Aulan realized that there were many more. A ladder of handholds, moving right up the rock face. She put her hand in the lowest, but looked back to Shona, for this seemed a truly treacherous climb. Aulan could go up the tallest tree without reservation, and didn't shy from scrambling all about boulder tumbles. But this, this was an ascent straight up the side of a sheer rise, a cliff as tall as 10 tall warriors standing one atop the other. But Shona just nodded to her, imploring her to climb. Aulan swallowed hard, brought her torso right against the stone, and started to pull herself up that she could reach the next hold with her other hand. And suddenly she felt weightless, felt as though she could leap into the sky and never come down. She raised herself easily, so easily, with her one hand caught the next handhold and propelled herself higher, not even bothering to set her foot in the first handhold as she scaled higher. She felt as if she was floating up the rock face, and she gained speed with every pull. Again and again, hand over hand, she effortlessly ascended. She glanced back down below at Shona, to see the woman, head bowed in concentration, one hand clenched tightly against her breast, pulling herself up the cliff methodically and carefully with her other hand. Aulin understood that the magic was in that clenched fist, was coursing through Shona and being extended from Shona to her. The implications. The power jolted the young woman. Aulin had felt the magic internally with the crystals she had touched, and again when she had gazed upon the crystal manifestation of Uskar. She knew, of course, that the blessed weapons could bring forth magical effects, like making the warriors lighter on their feet, offering a bit of flame to make a weapon strike more lethal, even to impart some minor healing to the fighters. But this was something far more profound, something Aulin had never even dared to fantasize about. This was all the whispers of the coven's power revealed to be anything but exaggerations. Aulin crested the cliff face to see the fire and six people, two women and four men, visible in the light about it, including Meren and another member of the coven named Conabra. Lauch Te Oleg was there, and a couple of others with him, but they were back in the shadows, and she couldn't recognize them from this side of the fire. The last man was Breith. He sat before the fire, wearing no shirt, nothing at all from the waist up. She focused too intently on the gathering, though, for as she came up over the ledge, Shona's levitating magic left her, and she very nearly fell on her face, catching herself awkwardly to turn her tumble into a less than graceful stumble. She had already felt very small, a girl again, when she recognized these powerful Uskar, and now the poor girl blushed fiercely and wanted to simply run away. But she didn't. She righted herself and stood silently, if uncomfortably, and waited with as much composure as she could manage for Shona to come up behind her. Even then, everyone continued to stare at poor Aulin, and those looks seemed to her to be growing more judgmental. She didn't understand until Shona nudged her, rather forcefully, toward the fire. When Aulin looked back in surprise, Shona led her gaze to the pouch on her belt. The girl flushed red, even more uneasy, for she had forgotten all about the seeds. She quickly and roughly pulled the bag off her belt and fumbled with its drawstring, finally getting it open so she could spill its contents into the fire. She nearly dropped the bag into the fire as well, but managed to catch it just at her fingertips. "Sorry," she whispered, not to anyone in particular, and, indeed, no one seemed to hear or care. And a moment later, Aulin didn't care either. For as soon as the seeds hit the fire, they burst, casting off a pink haze, a sudden blast of heat and smoke that caught Aulin full in the face. She coughed and sputtered and stumbled backward to sit on the ground. She didn't actually mean to sit down, but suddenly the world had become very bendy, and standing was no longer an option. She felt as though she might throw up, but she held it down. Her eyes couldn't seem to come into focus. She saw the man who was sitting across from her reach out over the fire pit, holding something red, a slab of meat, which he dropped onto a stone in the center of the fire. Aulin couldn't make sense of it, and felt utterly lost here. Yet no one spoke. After a moment, the man reached his hand across the fire, toward Aulin. She gazed at the arm, and then his bare chest, and saw something unexpected. Breith's torso was intricately tattooed, delicate lines weaving all about. The light from the fire danced across his chest, mesmerizing Aulin. She thought them beautiful. She thought them profound. Breith spoke, but she did not hear his words. Whatever was said was not as important as those tattoos. She felt a prod from behind, from Shona, and when she lazily looked up, the woman's scowl snapped her back to her senses. The man spoke again, a single word. Cork, the old word for a knife. "Oh, yes," Aulin said, fumbling. Finally, she grabbed the flint knife from her belt and placed it upon Braith's open palm. Suddenly his other arm came forward, directly across the fire, caring not at all about the wisps of flames that seemed to almost encircle his forearm. And he grasped Erlin by the wrist, and not gently.
She tried to pull away, but the man was much stronger than she, and he easily yanked her in closer.
He brought the knife up to the side of her forehead, and again she tried to shy away, tried to fall back from the sharp edge of the flint, but she could not. Then, as suddenly as he'd lunged at her, he withdrew. She felt the slightest trickle of blood dripping down from her right temple, tracing the line of her high cheekbones and all the way down to her chin. Reflexively, her tongue flicked out to taste her own blood, but she kept her eyes locked on the man. He took the knife and brought it to his own temple. Aulan saw the red stain on the blade as he moved it. Her blood. Then there was more redness on his face. His own blood. On the flint blade, they mixed. He reached again into the fire, to the piece of meat cooking on the stone slab. In a series of practiced movements, the tattooed warrior stabbed the meat and lifted it to his free hand, held it aloft, and adeptly cut it in half. Breyth took up one half of the meat, and beckoned for Aulan to do likewise. Aulan hesitated. The fallen half of the meat was out in the center of the fire pit. Surely she would burn herself trying to grab it. But Shona prodded her from behind again, hard. Hesitantly, she reached out, expecting to feel the biting flames. But she felt no heat. Her hand shimmered, a white glow surrounding it. Aulan paused for just a moment to consider this strange luminescence covering her arm. She took the meat between her fingers and brought it to her mouth. With the warrior holding her stare with his own, they each took a bite. Shona said something Aulan did not quite hear, then stepped forward and tossed something into the fire. More of those seeds! A huge burst of purple smoke rose up into Aulan's face, and suddenly the world warped and bent again, even more so, and she could not hold her balance, and she was only slightly aware that she was lying down, and then not aware of anything.
"You must never,"
Ineva scolded her son, trying to keep her voice down. The woman glanced all about, panicked, as if she expected a host of Uskar demons to crash into the tree cave and drag Thump away to be tortured and murdered. She rubbed her face, trying to find some measure of composure, as she looked back to her discovery. A broken branch, as thick as two fingers, and fully as long as her arm, with its end sharpened wickedly, even with a barb whittled in to prevent easy extraction. She looked at her son, unable to form any more words in that moment of horror, and just shook her head. Then she grabbed him and pulled him in close for a desperate hug.
"I don't like what they do to you," he whispered.
Ineva pushed him back to arm's length. Thump painted on a determined expression, full of hate, his young eyes promising death.
"They will do far worse if you strike at them," Ineva warned. "Do you understand me?"
The boy started to look away, but Ineva shook him hard.
"Do you understand me?"
she repeated emphatically.
"I won't,"
Thump replied.
"Promise me."
The boy nodded.
"You made this to stab a man, yes?"
the woman asked, and she managed to smile.
"Because of what you saw?"
Thump shook his head, but she didn't believe him. Not at first, at least. But then she recalled something else about that difficult night a month before.
"Was it for the young girl?"
she asked, her expression one of horror. Thump seemed genuinely confused at that question.
"The girl who took you out that day,"
Ineva started to clarify, but Thump waved his hands frantically and shook his head.
"No, no," he said, "no."
Ineva looked at him curiously.
"Was she mean to you?"
The boy swallowed hard and shook his head, slowly at first, but then emphatically.
Did you enjoy your day with her?
Ineva asked very seriously, enunciating each word to stress the importance of the question, and of Thump's honesty here. Several heartbeats passed before Thump answered,
She named me Padlan.
Ineva's expression showed that she did not understand.
Thump, the boy explained, but hoofbeats, running deer.
Yes, yes,
Ineva said, catching on, for she knew the word.
But why would she give you that name, when your name is known?
The boy glanced down, and Ineva reached out and took him by the chin, forcing him to look her in the eye.
They mock me, he said quietly.
This girl mocked you?
No.
Ineva began to catch on, and she sucked in her breath as she considered the humiliation her tactics had forced upon her son. Surely that was better than the alternative, particularly in the coming years, perhaps even months, when he came to manhood, and the Uskar would surely murder him. But still, the woman did not dismiss Thump's current pain. She understood that what was being demanded of her poor boy was beyond what anyone should have to endure. His entire life had been a carnival of horror and humiliation. She pulled him close and hugged him again, in no small part because she didn't want him to see the tears pouring out of her eyes.
She was nice to me, Thump whispered in her ear, and Ineva heaved a great sob.
But suddenly she shoved him back once more as terror engulfed her.
Did you talk to her? She asked.
The boy shook his head, but unconvincingly.
Did she hear you talk? Does she know the truth? Ineva pressed.
Thump swallowed hard. Ineva's first instinct was to slap him, to scream out in terror that her son had just signed a terrible death sentence. But she stopped short and fought for composure. She couldn't undo whatever had happened, and she really didn't want to put more trauma on the poor boy.
No, you must never, never, she told him through gritted teeth. You are stupid. Do you understand? They must never know.
Thump stared at her blankly, and the pain of seeing that drove an emotional spear right into the poor, broken woman's heart. She reminded herself that this was for the good of her son, and repeated slowly and clearly,
You are stupid.
14. Rough and Tumble. He wasn't afraid to let the raft he had constructed continue its meandering way along the river at this particular point, even though night had fallen. Talmadge knew this area well, and knew that this late in the season, one that hadn't seen much rain, the river would hold no secret rapids. So he glided along, enjoying the stars, believing himself safer than he would have been with the raft secured along the banks. The wolves wouldn't come out onto the water, after all, and he'd hear a bear or a huge elk long before it got near to him. His eyes closed slowly, his head drooped, lulled by the rhythmic flow and the trilling and croaking frogs. Of all things he liked the most about the open and unsettled lands were the sounds of the night. They blended together and swirled around, like the leaves of a thick tree in a gentle breeze. Only rarely did these nighttime symphonies sound a note discordant. The last scream of prey caught, or the insane yipping of the thick-necked hyenas chattering before dinner over a fresh kill. The frogs answered from bank to bank. The night birds cooed mellow crescendos to the river's soothing drone. The shriek of a metal sword skipping off a stone. Talmadge's eyes popped open. He tried to sort out that last noise, or was it a dream's sound? A shout sounded on the right-hand bank, then a grunt and a curse in a language Talmadge did not know. The man struggled to his feet and gathered his long pole, straining his eyes in the darkness.
He saw the light of a campfire, just back from the river to the right, the north, and heard a continuing, rising commotion. A big part of him just wanted to float by. This wasn't his fight. But he heard a man cry out,
"It got me!"
in such desperate tones that Talmadge could not turn away. Into the river went his pole, and with the gentle current, it was no trouble for Talmadge to push the raft toward the river bank. He found a rocky eddy, where it was easy to put in, and dropped the pole and leaped off the raft before it had even secured itself against the stones. He stumbled in the muddy ground, but managed to pull his battle-axe from his back as he made his somewhat cautious way toward the fire and the apparent fight. He noted forms, then, a couple of humans and smaller ones, ones that looked like older boys, perhaps.
"Goblins," he said, crossing through the brush.
Before he had even cleared it, he came upon one of the ugly creatures brandishing a pair of hooked knives. The green-skinned humanoid leapt in surprise, swinging about, and launched a wild flurry of spinning arms and slashing blades that got nowhere close to Talmadge. The goblin's long ears, too, waggled wildly, its head gyrating, and Talmadge deduced that the whole of the motion was meant to present a wall of ferocity, was meant to intimidate and confuse. But Talmadge had heard enough about goblins to recognize the ruse, and so he waded straight in. His overhead chop stopped the waggling and dancing, as his axe buried into the monster's skull. A yank brought the sharp sound of cracking bone as Talmadge charged past into the firelight.
He took a quick survey of the scene, noting a trio, two women and a man, forming a triangular defense against a bevy of darting and stabbing goblins.
A fourth frontiersman, a long and lean man, lay on the ground some distance to the side, squirming and slapping his arms about desperately. He bled from a number of wounds, and with more incoming as a group of several goblins rushed all about him, spitting and cursing and stabbing down at him with their spears, which really were no more than sharpened sticks. "To us, friend," one of the women called, spotting Talmadge, and he started that way. Only a step, though, for he realized that they would never get their formation to their friend in time, a point driven home as the end of a goblin's sharp stick was driven home, right into the eye of the poor soul lying on the ground. How he howled! And how Talmadge roared! He veered straight for the fallen man and through the small campfire. He kicked at it as he crashed through, sending embers and small burning logs flying at the goblins, and he followed the wall of sparks into their midst, sweeping across powerfully with his axe, sending them leaping back. Back and forth, Talmadge whipped his weapon, shouting all the while, trying to buy some time for the fallen man's friends to join in. He glanced back at them briefly to see their progress halted by a volley of thrown spears.
"Just take the hit," he mouthed under his breath,
for none of those feeble weapons had any weight to them or any real power behind the throw.
Talmadge slid his hands as far apart as he could on his axe handle, and turned back just in time to see a spear thrust aimed for his gut.
He swept his hands down and to the side, knocking the stab off target, then punched back with his left hand and the butt of his axe. He loosened his grip with that leading left hand, and when the punch fell just short, the goblin bit at him. But Talmadge gave it a mouthful of axe handle instead, sliding the shaft through his loosened fingers. The goblin's head snapped backward, and it staggered back to trip over the fallen frontiersman. From the left side came another goblin, but Talmadge just grasped the axe mid-handle with his left, let go with his right, and swept it out to fend. And from his left hip, he drew his short sword, a weapon that had been with him since the day he had walked out of his dying hometown. He roared and leaped forward, straddling the fallen man, stabbing and slashing and hopping about to keep the remaining four goblins at bay. The one on the ground tried to rise, but a thrust of the short sword laid it low, and Talmadge tucked his weapon back just in time, and fortunately, at just the right angle, to knock a thrown spear aside. The now unarmed goblin cursed. It should have fled. Talmadge leapt at it. The goblin managed to sidestep the sword. The blade attack was a feint, though, coming in slightly to the left of the goblin and forcing it back to the right. Focusing on that thrust, the goblin managed to jump right under the head of the descending axe. Talmadge whirled about and screamed at a goblin driving a spear into the man on the ground. Purely on reaction, he flung his axe on target, but the weapon hadn't fully come around to dig in and just bounced off the creature. That was enough to send it running, especially with Talmadge charging in fast behind. The frontiersman paused only long enough to scoop his fallen weapon. That was his plan, at least. But even as he bent for his axe, he felt an explosion of pain just behind his hip that sent him staggering forward and to one knee. He glanced at the wound to see a dagger sticking there. But he hadn't the time to go for it, as a pair of goblins came in at him hard, spears thrusting. He got stabbed in the forearm before he could sweep that arm and the axe aside, and traded hits the other way, a spear coming at his chest with his short sword catching a goblin in the throat, gashing it from ear to ear. A finer weapon would have driven hard through Talmadge's thin leather jerkin and deep into his lung, and would have likely spelled the end of the man. Even as it was, the weapon stayed in place, embedded through the shirt and into Talmadge's flesh, painfully against his ribs. He tried to slap at it to dislodge it, but was instead forced to bring his sword up before him to try to block another incoming missile. This time it was a stone, a heavy one, and it tipped off the metal blade and bounced off the side of Talmadge's head. The world was spinning then, but the man knew that he could not simply lie down and huddle in pain. More goblins came in at him, or went past him, and only after many sweeps and stabs, hitting nothing at all, did Talmadge realize that they were in retreat and wanted no part of him, or of the other three humans who had broken through the encircling ring. "They should have stayed," Talmadge managed to say, dropping his axe and reaching tentatively for the spear sticking into his chest. He started to finish "they could have won," but ran out of breath. He looked back to see that the trio were hovering over their prone friend, who was no longer moving and covered in blood, and paying Talmadge no heed. Talmadge looked at the gash running the length of his forearm. He felt like he would throw up. He felt like he would faint. He chose the latter, rolling down into the dirt, welcoming the darkness. He wanted to open his eyes, but it took a long time for his body to agree. He could feel the heat of the fire before he actually saw the orange glow, then lolled his head to the side to see it more clearly. He turned his head back, his gaze going up to the starlit sky. He was lying on his back. His chest ached. His hip was worse, and he had a throbbing headache. Instinctively, Talmadge reached up for his temple, or tried to, but he found that his hands were caught beneath him. He struggled a bit and realized that, no, they weren't caught. They were tied. Had the goblins won? "Hey, he's awake," he heard from the side. A human voice, a woman's voice, and no goblin. A moment later, the woman leaned over him, looking down. "You wasn't hurt that bad," she said. "Are you all about fainting, then?" She laughed at him and moved aside. The other woman was beside him then, kneeling and helping him to sit up. The world spun for a moment with the movement, and it took Talmadge a while for his eyes to catch up to his senses. As they focused in, the first image he saw was that of a goblin, leering at him. He tried to fall back, but the woman held him in place. He started to protest, but stopped short as he realized that the goblin wasn't alive, but was staked just to the side of the fire. Talmadge shook his head. He had only seen a few of these troublesome beasts over the years, all but a couple of times, from afar, though he had encountered their sign, camps littered with half-eaten rodents and lizards. Every time he saw a goblin's face,
Talmadge couldn't shake the ridiculous thought that someone had grabbed it by the nose and pulled hard, shrinking the thing's head into a tiny, wrinkled mess, and leaving the nose and ears absurdly long and crooked. He preferred to see them dead. Past the goblin, one of the people he saved was digging at the ground with another form, long and tall, lying behind him. Digging a grave, Talmadge realized, and he thought of the man on the ground, the goblins sticking him with their nasty spears.
"So, you finally come back to us, eh?"
asked the first woman.
"I got hit in the head," he mumbled.
"I should be hitting you in the head,"
the woman retorted, with more than a little ire in her voice. The man stopped his digging and came over then, hands on hips, a scowl on his dirty, bloody face. He spat on the ground.
"All you had to do was keep him safe a bit longer,"
the woman said.
"He tried,"
the woman kneeling beside Talmadge started to say, but her voice thinned and disappeared under the withering gaze of her two companions.
"I killed a goblin," Talmadge said.
"Aye, you did," the man agreed. "I'll give you that."
"Why am I tied?"
"Because we're not knowing who you are,"
said the first woman, who seemed to Talmadge to be the leader.
"Oh, he wasn't, at least," she added with a grin, and she took a handful of pearls out of her pocket and began dropping them from hand to hand in full view of Talmadge.
"My name is Talmadge," he started to say.
"We know,"
the woman interrupted.
"Know who you are, and know what game you got going for yourself all these years."
"Game?" Talmadge tried to make some sense of it all. He looked more closely at the apparent leader. She was fairly tall and incredibly skinny, with long, light brown hair and a mouth full of crooked and snaggled teeth, more than one looking more green than white.
Had he seen her before at matinee, he wondered.
Probably, he decided, though he couldn't place her. Almost everyone out here, not of the indigenous tribes, attended matinee. The man beside her was short and barrel-chested, with a giant black beard and unkempt hair that hung below his shoulders. Unremarkable among frontiersmen, surely. The woman at Talmadge's side was quite a bit younger than the other two, with her red hair cropped short. She had a nasty scar on the left side of her face from ear to chin, but Talmadge thought her attractive, the softness about her face, and gentle light eyes.
Yes, Talmadge had seen this one the previous year, but only from afar.
"So, Mr. Talmadge," said the skinny one, "we saved your life."
"I joined in your fight," Talmadge corrected.
The woman spat on the ground.
"Bah, but we had it won. Only thing you might have done was save Ricka there, and you failed at it, eh?"
"He was already down, being stabbed."
"Shut up,"
the man bellowed. He came forward, moving past the staked goblin to tower right before the seated Talmadge.
"Yes, shut up, or I'll put me boot deep into your craw, what?"
Talmadge swallowed hard.
"Shut up, except for what we're asking you,"
the skinny woman corrected, also moving over to stand beside the man.
"'Tweren't your good fortune to come upon us, Mr. Talmadge, and 'tweren't your good choice to join in when you wasn't asked?"
Talmadge wanted to argue. The whole thing seemed so absurd. But she rolled the pearls from one hand to the other in clear view then, and he began to better understand.
"So, we're thinking that it's time for Mr. Talmadge to share his bounty," said the skinny one. "You're on your way to that lake."
"No," he said.
The woman kneeling beside him whacked him across the side of the head with a thick stick, pitching him over to go face down into the dirt. Before he could even straighten out, she grabbed him by the hair and the collar and tugged him back into a seated position. With that handful of hair, she yanked his head around to look him square in the eye, and there was nothing soft about her appearance or demeanor now.
"Whene'er I hear you lie, I'm to whack you,"
she explained, holding up the stick, and seeming quite willing, even happy, to prove her point again.
"So, you're going to the lake," said the skinny woman, "and we're going with you."
Talmadge wanted to scream at her. This wasn't the way they lived out here in the wilds. They didn't fight each other, murder each other, and especially not with someone who had come in to help them in a fight. As tough as they were, the frontiersmen were not thieves. Talmadge wanted to scream all of that, and yet he knew, obviously, that his protest would catch the wind and nothing more, and would probably earn him another crack on the head from the younger woman as well. So he sat there and shook his head, his expression dumbfounded and full of disappointment.
"Now," said the man, "if you take us to the lake and behave, we might let you live, and even if we don't, we'll kill you quick and easy."
Talmadge stared at him hard. He didn't need to ask what would happen if he didn't cooperate, but the man volunteered it anyway.
"And if you're not behaving, we'll roast you, bit by little bit, until you do."
He reached into the remaining bits of campfire, and brought forth a brand, and thrust the burning end in Talmadge's direction.
"Now what's your choice, boy?"
he asked, or tried to, for before he had quite finished, his words became a dissipating mess of undecipherable sounds, and he stared at Talmadge weirdly, too weirdly. And so it took the seated man a few moments to even realize what had happened, to even realize that the brute had an arrow sticking into his face, through both cheeks. His jaw crooked from the arrow. He garbled a few more sounds and went down to the ground, trying to summon the nerve to bring his trembling hand to the embedded bolt. The woman beside Talmadge leaped up, drawing her sword. The skinny woman spun about to face the direction of the attack, falling into a crouch, sword in hand. And in came the attacker in a full charge, shouting and waving a small whip in one hand, a hooked knife in the other. She dived and rolled and slid in between the two rogues on her back, whip cracking and with legs up, feet kicking.
"Hote!"
Talmadge gasped, caught by surprise and by fear for the woman. Why was she on the ground? Had she tripped? It took him a while to properly understand that this maneuver was by design, for Cote fought prone from her back, ferociously, spinning, kicking, lifting up high with her legs, and even lower back, to drive away the two women. She used the cracking whip as more of a diversion, but those legs were doing the damage, and more damage than Talmadge could imagine, with both rogue women bleeding from their thighs and pelvises and bellies. For knife blades extended from Chote's boots. To the side, the man struggled to his feet, ready to join in despite the arrow still sticking through his face. Talmadge rolled over onto his knees, then struggled up as the man came across. With a growl of protest, Talmadge launched himself forward into the rogue, bullying him to the side and into the remaining campfire. The man cried out and began frantically patting at his burning clothes and rolling about, which jarred the arrow, which made him cry out all the louder. Talmadge fell back down and curled, bringing his arms down below his bum and up along his tucking legs, trying to get his tied hands in front of him at least. By the time he managed that and climbed back to his feet, the young red-haired woman was down on one knee, holding at a myriad of wounds, and with one arm out toward Chote in a gesture of surrender. The other woman had backed out of reach, and so Chote executed a graceful lift and twist, leaping up from the ground in a practiced twirl, landing on her feet before the woman, and launching immediately into a high-flying circle kick. The skinny woman ducked and came right in, but was straightened abruptly as Chote came fully around, whip-leading and whip-snapping right across the woman's neck. Dazed and stung, the skinny woman stumbled backward, but not fast enough as Cote came in hard, her other hand holding the hooked knife, punching out, crushing the skinny woman's nose with the metal pommel. The woman's head snapped back and she fell over to the ground and curled up, only semi-conscious and groaning loudly. Kote spun back and rushed past the kneeling redhead and over to Talmadge, who lifted his hands defensively and cried out, thinking that Kote, in her battle frenzy, didn't even recognize him. Down came her hooked knife right between his extended arms, slicing the bonds.
Kote motioned to one of the fallen swords.
"Keep them caught," she said, and she leaped the fire and charged straight in at the man, spinning, whip cracking. He straightened. She dived forward and rolled onto her back, and as she did, Talmadge noted her hand going to her waist and grabbing at something set there. He understood when she kicked the rogue inside his knee, the knife that extended from her boot cutting in hard and sending him down and squirming, this time to stay. As Kote leaped up, Talmadge realized that the blade was retractable, like a cat's claws, with some kind of mechanism running inside Kote's pant leg. Kote calmly walked back from the man, leaving him thrashing and howling on the ground. The skinny woman had stopped squirming then, and lay quite unconscious in the dirt, and the red-haired woman hadn't even attempted to stand up once more. Kote stopped short, though, and moved to the side, to the grave the man had been digging. She picked up a rock, a headstone, stared at it for a moment, then chuckled and moved to join Talmadge. "Now what?" he asked.
"Not even a thank you."
"Thank you," he said. "Now what?" Kote shrugged.
"We are justified in killing them."
"No." Kote stared at him, and he made sure that there was no compromise revealed in his expression. He couldn't kill these three. He simply couldn't. An Kote smiled, and seemed to understand. She looked around.
"There is a gully not far from here, long and deep. We lower them down the side and leave them. We will be long gone before they can make their way out."
"Leave them, and then we go where?"
Kote smiled. Talmadge shook his head.
"Don't be stubborn," she said. "You owe me this, at least. I just saved your life."
"They weren't going to kill me," he insisted.
Kote gave him a skeptical look, then tossed the headstone to the ground at his feet. It landed upright, giving the man a clear view of the inscription. "Talmadge."
"They would have left you dead under the waters of your faraway lake," Kote said.
And Talmadge knew it to be true.
"And would have explained any reasons away by telling all that you were killed here by goblins."
The man shrugged.
"Good," said Kote,
clearly taking that as a surrender and a recognition that Talmadge would lead her to this faraway Loch Bjug.
"I will heat some water so we can clean up your wounds."
She paused, then added,
"And theirs."
"Why is this so important to you?"
Talmadge asked as she started to walk to the fire. Kote turned to regard him, a wry grin on her face.
"I am writing my story," she said. "We all are. I want my story to be wide."
Talmadge wasn't quite sure how to take that, but this wasn't the first time Kote had spoken of adventures in that manner. When she was trying to convince him to go far to the east to meet with Redshanks, she had used similar words, saying that he needed to widen his tale. The skinny woman groaned then and began to stir, so Talmadge let it go at that. Early the next morning, the couple marched the three rogues to a ledge above a nearly vertical cliff. They set some ropes and forced the rogues down, one by one. And when the last had safely reached the bottom, they pulled up the ropes and tossed down some supplies, including the rogue's weapons.
"You are being more generous than most," Kote said to Talmadge
as he lowered that last bundle. The man could only shrug and reply, "Goblins, I'll not leave them to be slaughtered."
"They meant to kill you."
Talmadge just shook his head to toss aside that unsettling thought. It was true enough, of course, and he would have been well within his rights, and none would have blamed him if he had simply killed the three back in their camp. But he couldn't do it. The mere thought of it horrified him.
Maybe they deserved it. Many would say so. But he simply couldn't. He would write his story, as Cathay always said, but it would be one with as few dead at the hands of Talmadge as